Ladies and gentlemen, live from the West Coast, it's time for Ring Talk Live Worldwide. Your inside look into combat sports, brought to you by the WBO, the World Boxing Organization.
Pedro, let me tell you congratulations on your long time in radio. You are your team and for your ratings, man. I was reading about that. I'm very impressed with you, Pedro.
And now, the host of the longest running fight show in radio and internet history.
I don't want to predict this fight, but, you know, I'm going to promise that I can give a good fight, you know, to make people happy, and I just do my best.
Pedro Fernandez.
If I can't teach you one way, I'll teach you another, but I'm going to get the job done.
Damas y caballeros, bienvenidos, ladies and gentlemen, emanating, coming at you from the multi-million dollar Sports Byline Studios in San Francisco, California. Check it. This is Ring Talk Live Worldwide. 35, make that 36 plus years now of being often imitated but never duplicated. Here I sit high atop my throne. My name is Pedro Fernandez. Welcome to Ring Talk Live Worldwide. We're doing a live broadcast right now, of course, live all over the world via Twitch.tv. Check out the Sports Byline USA channel, of course. We'll do a live broadcast on Twitch.tv this hour, and we'll feature Mike Tyson and Buster Douglas. In other words, we'll take my ugly mug off the camera in about 2 or 3 minutes and go straight with Mike Tyson and Buster Douglas. Of course, the meltdown in Tokyo, the end of Mike Tyson's undefeated run back February 1990, man. What can I say? Buster Douglas came to fight. Mike Tyson came to fight, but Buster was better than that, no doubt about it. We'll show that live. We'll show that live, the film of that, on the Twitch.tv Sports Byline USA channel. As far as the radio end of this is concerned, we'll bring in, of course, we'll hear a little bit of Mike Tyson. We'll hear a little about Mike Tyson. Of course, Mike Tyson, the former world heavyweight champion, talking about a comeback. People are excited about that. That's what people talk to me about on the street. Mike Tyson, Mike Tyson, Mike Tyson, Mike Tyson. And I say to myself, why are we talking about a 52-year-old guy? Well, it's Mike Tyson, you know, and people say he's really popular. And I don't know how popular he is, because he was on All Elite Wrestling a few weeks ago, and they had dismal numbers. They didn't get any big numbers with him, and it was all kinds of advertisement that he was going to be on the show. So what Mike Tyson used to be worth at one point in time, he might not be worth at this time in 2020. You are tuned to Ring Talk, live coming to you from the Sports Byline Studios here in the city of By the Bay. Ring Talk Live Worldwide continues after the break.
Comes the decision now. Let's listen.
Clarity in the world of professional boxing is spelled WBO. That's right. The World Boxing Organization is boxing's only transparent sanctioned body. You can follow the WBO on Facebook or check out their website, WBOboxing.com. That's WBOboxing.com. The World Boxing Organization.
I went to penitentiary, Gene Wilder. I did a movie. I went to, not me personally, I mean, I went to do a film in penitentiary. I was up there 6 weeks, Arizona State Penitentiary. It was something. Oh, you're applauding for that? Arizona State Penitentiary, real popular. Oh, man, it was strange because it's like 80% black people. And what's strange about that is that there are no black people in Arizona.
Now, more of Ring Talk with Pedro Fernandez.
Clap your hands, sir. Stop being racist. Clap your hands.
The Sports Byline USA Twitch.tv channel, of course, has got Mike Tyson and Buster Douglas hooking it up, of course, for the World Heavyweight Championship. February 1990, Mike's in the pre-fight rambles right now, but we will show it entirely on Twitch.tv, the Sports Byline USA channel, this hour, of course, accompanying the Ring Talk audio. Now, let me tell you about a guy that I met back in 1984. I'm sitting in a big hot tub at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs. In other words, I was fortunate enough to hang out with these guys like Mike Tyson and Mark Breland and people like that. And Michael Nunn was there. Michael Nunn, of course, would become the future IBF world middleweight champion, 160-pound champion, Michael second to none from Davenport, Iowa. So anyway, Mike Tyson and Michael Nunn were going back and forth. They were in a capping session. You know how you cap on guys like, you know, your mother's got 6 feet or something like that, blah, blah, blah. You know, go back and forth insulting each other. Well, anyway, Mike Tyson said, I knew your mother when she was hoeing. He said that to Michael Nunn. And Michael Nunn got up and walked across the, there was this big old hot tub. It's like as big as a swimming pool. Okay. So Michael Nunn gets up and walks across the tub and tells Mike Tyson to get up because he's going to fight Mike Tyson over there. And there's all kinds of exchanges going back and forth. I mean, filthy words, the whole nine yards, all coming from Michael Nunn. Mike Tyson didn't say a word. So I'm saying to myself, man, Mike might be a little bit of a punk here, not at least getting up against a guy that weighs 50 pounds less than him. At least I'd at least said something back after talking all that smack. Anyway, Mike didn't do it. So Michael Nunn ends up turning pro, doesn't make the 1984 Olympic team, neither do Mike Tyson, ends up turning pro, ends up being, I think he went a record of 62-4 with like 37 wax scores, the IBF middleweight champion. So he knocks out Sambu Kalembe in March of 1989, and he knocks him out in one or two rounds in Las Vegas, and me and Ray Leonard were there doing the TV together, and of course, I was doing the international, Ray was doing the regular HBO, I believe, and so me and Ray hook up at Botany's Disco a little bit later tonight. Of course, Botany's was a place that we used to have the run of. I'm talking about myself, Ray Leonard, Aaron Pryor, people like that. There was those of us who were hip. We had our own little clique at Botany's, and the Shark Club as well. But Botany's really, there's no doubt about it. That was our turf. No doubt about that. So anyway, so Ray shows up to Botany's one night, and Michael Nunn shows up about 15 minutes later. So I'm sitting there with Ray, and we got some girls at the table. And I say to Ray, Michael Nunn thinks you're scared of him. I'm just talking smack. Michael Nunn thinks you're scared of him, especially after that knockout, one-punch knockout tonight, Ray. I mean, you aren't talking about fighting Kalembe. You aren't talking about fighting Kalembe or Michael Nunn. So bottom line is they say that, it's perceived that you're scared of Michael Nunn. So Ray's, I guess, had a couple of drinks, this and that, and he's feeling good about himself, this and that, right? So Ray goes over and gets right in Michael Nunn's face. I mean, these guys were nose to nose, man. Nose to nose. Here I am starting trouble in the disco in Las Vegas, but nose to nose. They never ended up fighting. The reason why I bring up Michael Nunn is that Michael Nunn, of course, was, as I said, a boxing prodigy in the amateurs out of Davenport, Iowa. There was a guy that's sort of like a stepfather to him. It was a guy by the name of Bob Surkine, Surkein, I believe, and he was a Southern California boxing official, if I remember it right, Southern California amateur boxing official. But he took Nunn under his wing, and he sort of looked after Nunn. He just did. And I remember him telling me in about 1987, 88, somewhere around there, the worst thing that happened to Michael Nunn, because he was working in training out of Rosita, California with the Goosens, he said the worst thing that happened to Nunn is that he would return to Davenport, Iowa. And I didn't know what he meant, because Davenport, Iowa is not considered like Detroit or, some ghetto hotbed or something like that. But anyway, after his career was over, Michael Nunn did return to Davenport, Iowa. And guess what? Bob Surkine's words rang true, because evidently Michael sold a cocaine, or tried to buy a kilo of cocaine off a cop, and ended up getting 8 or 10 years for it. I kid you not. Like 8 or 10 or 12 years for trying to buy a kilo of cocaine. I kid you, but it just went down that way because of the fact that Michael Nunn had other issues with the authorities in Davenport, Iowa. In other words, he was a bit of a punk. Thought he was a little bit too cool, a little bit too tough, a little bit too rough, went a little bit too street. So anyway, he goes to prison for a long time. He gets out, and this past Saturday night, he ends up getting into a match. They have a kickboxing match with Pat Miletich. Matt Miletich's been on the show in the past, of course, the former UFC champion. Was he UFC champion? I think he was UFC champion. Anyway, long in the tooth, no doubt about that. He's going to be about 55, 58 years old, and I think Nunn somewhere around 52, 53. Anyway, bottom line is they went in a kickboxing match last night, and Michael Nunn won a split decision. So I guess we want to congratulate Michael Nunn for that. But at the end of the day, man, he really could have been something. I mean, he lost to James Toney, and his world fell apart. I mean, it just did, and I think it all had to do with the fact that there may have been some Colombian dust involved. And anytime you get Colombian dust involved in boxing, man, bad things happen. They just do. I mean, I don't know any, but Hector Camacho. I mentioned him a little earlier. The Macho Man, the Harlem Heckler. You love that nickname I gave him, right? Cocaine, it killed him. I mean, killed his boxing career. Of course, that made him like the un-macho man when he fought Edwin Rosario and got lit up in the fifth round by that left hook. That sort of took the macho out of Hector Camacho. From that point forward, he sort of fought safety first. Okay, so it was a macho-less Hector Camacho, but I think a lot of that was brought on by the fact that he was so blow. I mean, blow was part of his. Hey, I'm not saying he had blow for breakfast cereal like Cheerios and things like that and Raisin Bran, but pretty close to it. I mean, Camacho dug his blow. When he wasn't fighting, he dug his blow. And he, when he was fighting, he dug his blow. Because I told you about the time that we were in, where were we in? Carolina, Puerto Rico. Actually, San Juan, Puerto Rico. But I think the fight arena was in Carolina, Puerto Rico. This was circa 2000, 2002, somewhere around there. Anyway, Camacho's not coming to the fight. What do you mean Camacho's not coming to the fight? He's in the main event against Jorge Vaca, former WBC welterweight champion out of Mexico. So Camacho and this guy are going to go 12 rounds or less in the main event, right? Well, Camacho's not going to show up. He's all coked out in the hotel. He won't leave the hotel. He's coked out. Harold Smith comes in and tells me, Pedro, you're going to have to do the show without Camacho. I mean, whatever. We can't do the show without Camacho. I can't tell. I'm going to tell, like, you want me to tell the 5,000? That's what he wanted me to do. He wanted me to tell the 5,000 people in attendance that Camacho wasn't coming. Are you crazy? I'm going to tell 5,000 Puerto Rican boxing fans that the guy they bought a ticket for is not coming? You got to be kidding me. And then he added this addendum to it. By the way, if Camacho ain't coming, you ain't getting paid. Say what? I've been in Puerto Rico for like a month and a half. I'm not getting paid. You got to be kidding me. So anyway, I got in the limo, took my ass back to the hotel, went up to Hector's room, banged on the room, banged on the room, banged on the room, banged on the door, started kicking the door. Yeah, I mean, I was making all kinds of noise out there. Hector wasn't answering the door because he was all blowed out on the other side, okay? Wasn't answering the door. Finally, I guess it drove him crazy because I just wouldn't go away. I just kept kicking the door. Finally, he opened the door, and here I'm sitting there in a tuxedo shirt, no tie, just a tuxedo shirt, sweating my ass off because, man, if this guy doesn't come to the arena, I'm not going to get my money. Bottom line is I don't have any money. I can't even get on an airplane to get out of here, okay? Is the airplane ticket going to be any good if the Camacho fight doesn't come through? So anyway, I get in the room with him, and I go into the room, and it's like a suite. And Camacho's got this coffee table, this kitchen table there, and he's got blow laid out on the kitchen table. I mean, blow laid out, big fat lines. So, you know, you ever seen what a Bic pen looks like? You want a Bic pen? Imagine a Bic pen in your mind right now. He had cocaine lines the size of Bic pens, two or three of them, right? And I said to myself, oh, that doesn't look good. That doesn't look good. That doesn't look good. Because I know what's going on. He's obviously blowed out. So I'm begging him. I'm telling him, listen, man, I said, you know, I'm not going to be able to feed my kid. My ex-lady is going to shut me down. They're going to take away my driver's license for not paying child support. I've been here a month and a half. I got to come back with some money, Hector. And they're not going to give me any money if you don't come to fight. Bro, please. Do I have to get on my knees? I mean, what do I need to do, Hector? You got to come fight for me. Please, please. So anyway, he looks at me. He takes the blow, does one long line, two long lines, three long lines, the last line. Okay, we're going to the arena. 30 seconds later, guess what, folks? We're on our way to the arena. Hector's flying, no doubt about that. He's flying about Hector the Macho Man Camacho. So that was it. That's sort of how the Jorge Vaca came to fruition. The Jorge Vaca fight came to fruition. What did Hector do in the first round? He headbutted Mr. Vaca, and the fight was over in like 15 seconds. At the end of the day, Hector showed up. I got paid. You are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide.
But like I said, he brings excellent condition and he's determined.
Why didn't you go after him to try to knock him out when you knocked him down early in the third round?
I said, why get callous if I've been training for 2 months?
Here's the knockdown. Describe it to us as you see it.
Well, like I told Jimmy, the 1-2 with you, I'm going to get him all the time. But I wasn't going to get overexcited and play myself cheap. I said, I'll knock him out early if it happens. If not, if it's necessary, I'll go 12 rounds, and I did.
Did you go to school, so to speak, on what happened to Rosario when he knocked him down and then he got knocked out himself?
No, because I knocked down a lot of fighters that still took my time. I'm just getting seasoned through every fight, and I'm pound for pound, I'm the best fighter pound for pound in the world. Bring him on. Bring him on. Mancini, I don't respect your opinion. Come on, baby. I could knock you out.
Well, who are some of the fighters?
Bernard Willeker. You could get some, baby. You could get some, too. Brian Boone. Jimmy Paul. Sammy Holmes. All your come on with it, baby. Yeah, buddy. Let's hear from you, Larry.
What about Aaron Pryor?
Aaron Pryor, come on with it, baby. I got faith in you. You bounce back. I know you. Come on, baby. Come on with it. It's Macho time.
Now, more of Ring Talk with Pedro Fernandez.
I had no choice.
The Macho Man, Hector Camacho, born May 24th, 1962, died on my birthday. This was sort of killed choker. November 24th, 2012. Shot in a car. Of course, cocaine was in the car. They were doing some blow. Guys were sharing a couple of lines. This guy was sharing, Camacho was sharing lines with the driver. The driver was an alleged drug dealer or a king drug kingpin. Call him what you want. But anyway, on my birthday in 2012, there's Camacho sitting in this car. I think it was Carolina, Puerto Rico. And the guy shot both guys and shot Camacho. And Emily got shot in the face, man. And that was all she wrote. The heck, the Camacho man was dead. Of course, God, that's hard to believe. And 88 fights in all. 88 fights. Holy cow. 79 wins, 6 losses. I think he was only, I don't think he was ever stopped. But the bottom line is, at the end of the day, the Macho Man, of course, had a son that fought, Hector Macho Jr., but not really all that macho. And he and I, of course, had our clashes. We sat together for the Trinidad Hopkins fight back in 2001. We sat together, and I realized that night that the kid was never going to be what the father was. Anyway, straight up, you are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide. You know, Mike Tyson's been in the news lately, no doubt about that. I mean, he's talking about comebacks and talk about his life now and karma and meditation. Of course, he still smokes a lot of weed, which I think is really cool. But the bottom line is, we're talking about Mike in prison today.
Well, former heavyweight boxing champ Mike Tyson certainly knows all about the harsh sound of those prison doors slamming behind him. Tyson spent a grueling 3 years in prison. It put his life in a tailspin. Well, I spoke with Iron Mike about the prison stint that forever changed his life for the better.
He went to prison for 3 years after being convicted of raping a beauty pageant contestant, and I know you still maintain your innocence in that case. But if you would, take me back to the moment. You step into that cell, the door closes behind you. What's going through your mind at that time?
Well, you know, I'm very depressed, but I'm really prepared for it, so I was prepared to go through the situation. But I just wanted to live my life every day. That's what you have to do. Everything you had outside, you have to check it at the door and go into this place a different person.
You were living, though, this life of luxury before that, a very out loud life of everything you could possibly have wanted. Give me a sense of what the adjustment was like, having to turn all that in.
Well, I was living a life of luxury in prison too, just not the same as I was outside. I didn't have any cars and stuff, but I had food. I was able to get what I wanted. I could do what I wanted. I had girlfriends, you know. So it wasn't like it's not like your freedom. All that stuff is just not like your freedom.
You say a life of luxury in prison, and I imagine I'd speak to a lot of other prisoners and they wouldn't have the same recollection of their experience. Is that because you are Mike Tyson and perhaps people were eager to give you more things than others would receive?
Well, I don't know. That had a lot to do with it, probably. But also, I know how to talk to people. You know, I'm not a big shot. I'm not no gangster. So I know how to talk to people, so things get done.
And what was a day like, a typical day for you there?
In prison?
Yeah.
I get up, go to the gym, work out, come back, get on the telephone, make phone calls, go to school, go to visits.
Did you at any point feel like you had to prove yourself to anybody, or did people steer clear of you because, hey, you're Mike Tyson?
No, I was just, I was a simple guy. I didn't have to fight nobody. I don't do the other guys a fight. You know, I was just a simple guy. I wasn't no big shot in prison. I wasn't no gangster, tough guy. I was just a simple guy in there.
But people must have treated you differently, and I was actually curious if anybody you ever found at any time came gunning for you because you were Mike Tyson, and maybe they felt like they had something to prove.
No, I never had that feeling either. No, I never had any problem in prison. If there were any, it's because I started them, you know. Sometimes I get carried away.
You got out of prison after serving 3 of a 6-year
yes.
sentence. And in your one-man show, you talk about how you still came out of prison an incredibly wealthy man. I want to take a look at that.
So after I left prison, I have to admit, I was scared. You ain't going to believe this shit. I had around $380 to $400 million in my bank account, right? Me. And not a clue how I was going to survive the next 400 seconds.
What exactly do you mean?
Well, I was getting prepared to come outside. I was pretty institutional. I was comfortable in prison. You know, everything, you know, I had no stress. Outside in the world, I had nothing but stress when I was out there last time. And I didn't know how I was going to do it. And and I was disastrous when I came out. I won a lot of money, but the life was too fast for me when I came out.
What was the toughest part of the adjustment back afterwards?
Yes, people, and violent. When I came out of prison, I was really violent for some reason. I was just violent, and I got in a lot of trouble, of course, you know, because I was violent when I came out. And I think I was real bitter when I came out. That's the reason I was that way.
Are you bitter now? Because a lot
not
of
now I'm you hear, back. You hear a lot 95 of, when I came out of prison, I was a maniac.
Was it based on because you do hear a lot of people who've come out of the system who feel like, especially if they maintain their innocence, that they were robbed of this time. In your case, 3 years of their life. Do you still feel any of that now?
Oh yeah, I feel that 100%. But I don't hold that to no bitterness. That's just something. That's just it occurred. It happened. A moment in time. It's a wrap. It's over. I'm doing this stuff now. I can't get that time back. This is what I'm doing now.
Would I be correct in my assessment, looking at you and talking to you and feeling your energy, that perhaps you're in the best part of your life right now?
At this stage of my life, it has to be. I've never been in a, you know, I've been in love with many women. It's not hard for me to be in love with anyone, but I've never been committed to any of them. I've always cheated on them, gave them venereal diseases or something. And I've never, you know, this is just what it is with my wife. We're together, and this is just what we're going to do. We're gonna, hopefully, God willing, we'll spend our lives together. That's just, the whole idea of that is just so riveting to me, that we'll stay together till one of us die.
She's a doctor. Give her some props because she's really put Mike together. I mean, Mike, of course, was on Prozac. Remember when Robin Gibbons put him on TV? He was like with Barbara Walters, something like that, and he was all drugged up on Prozac. Lithium. That's what it was. She said it was lithium. So anyway, she gave him some lithium before, and he was like, I know, Robin. And that was pretty sad. Anyway, bottom line is Mike's rebounded well. He really has. I mean, people say to me he would be dead by 50 and he wouldn't make 45. And there were people saying he wasn't going to make 40. I mean, all this smack. Mike has come back well. Alabama Boxing Hall of Fame inductions. Want to mention this. I don't know why they have all these guys standing together, but they do evidently 2020 Saturday at the Sky South Gym in Coffeyville, Alabama. These gentlemen were inducted to the Alabama Boxing Hall of Fame. And I do want to mention them in particular because of the fact that Frankie Randall was one of the people that were inducted. Frankie Randall was the first man to ever beat Julio Cesar Chavez. I mean, he beat Chavez down. And then in the rematch, he was kicking Chavez's ass, and Jose Sulman pulled some smack and took a couple of points, and they did some crazy scoring. At the end of the day, Randall didn't get the fight. Chavez got the fight, even though he turned away and was cut and bleeding. It was like a ripoff. It was like one of the biggest ripoffs I've ever witnessed in my life in boxing. I mean, Chavez was the benefactor, of course, with the Pernell Whitaker fight as well. That was held in Texas. But I'm telling you, anyway, Frankie Randall got really screwed. They didn't fight again for another 10 years. I think they fought a third time. But Randall had crack problems, crack cocaine problems. Couldn't handle the fact that, you know, I mean, here he had drawn this royal flush playing poker. Had drawn this royal flush, and he lost to a guy that had a pair of deuces. I mean, that's what it was. That's what it's like when you get screwed in boxing. People don't understand what I'm trying to say like that. Imagine this. You're a blackjack player. Are you going? The object is to get blackjack, which means a king and an ace, or a 10 and an ace. Means 21, you're going to win. It's your blackjack, okay? That means you're an instant winner, but not in the scoring of boxing, because you can have the instant win in your mind, and then some guys who beat you with a 16 or a 17. It seems physically, it seems emotionally impossible, but it happens all the time. In fact, people say to me, do you remember the fights? Do you remember the fights? You know what I remember about the big, I remember some of the controversial fights that I lost. That's what I remember the most. Well, I remember one referee pulled a stop, and I shoved him right after the stop. He pulled a stop, and I shoved him. I had knocked this guy down in the first round, had him on the deck, and they didn't like the fact that I stood over him, so I guess I had an attitude over that. They pushed me back away. We came back. We fought. He landed one right hand, and they jumped in and stopped the fight. So I knew the fix was in. I shoved the referee right then and there. So I put hands on a referee, right, which should have gotten me suspended. Guess what I got? It got the referee retrained. I was right on that point. Yeah, but you remember the times you got screwed? You just do. I mean, you don't remember the times you lose when you lost? Yeah, you know, I remember losing decisively. But those times you got screwed, you can't, I don't know how to measure it up against anything else. I really don't. A girlfriend cheating on you right in front of you? No, that ain't that bad. Getting screwed in a boxing match is the absolute worst. It just is. You fought your heart out. You fought your soul out, this and that. You know you won. Everybody in the place knows you won, except a couple of judges want to go the other way because maybe they like the other guy's trunks. straight up boxing, not as straight as you think it is. Ha ha, really? You are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide, your inside look in the world of boxing and MMA.
Decision now. Let's listen.
Clarity in the world of professional boxing is spelled WBO. That's right. The World Boxing Organization is boxing's only transparent sanctioned body. You can follow the WBO on Facebook or check out their website, WBOboxing.com. That's WBOboxing.com. The World Boxing Organization. While I consider myself a student of political assassinations of the 1960s, there are other people on this planet that consider me an expert. Straight up, I had a great time doing Black Op Radio a week ago.
In this next segment, we are talking to Pedro Fernandez, who has been on the show a few times on Black Op Radio. I met him in San Francisco at one of the conferences, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Hello, Pedro.
The godfather of the JFK movement right now. You are the guy. I'm talking about Mr. Lando Sanek. Pleasure to be here, sir.
Good. I wanted to offer just some, you know, short amount of time to each guest that I've had on over the years, as this is our 1,000th show, 20 years in the making, I've been calling it for everyone. And I know that you're very positive about that, so I would just ask you maybe for some comments about Black Op Radio and then and what you see in research coming up.
Well, let me start off with 50 reasons for 50 years. I thought that was probably something that should have won Emmys or some kind of awards, and somehow it just got ignored by the mainstream media, and shame on them for that, because it was probably one of the best productions that's ever been put forth. Black Op Radio, what can I say? It's my weekly sort of fix. I'm sort of hooked on it. It's sort of like a heroin habit, but it's a good thing. Every Thursday night around 6 o'clock, 6:30 out here on the West Coast, it's time to listen to Len and whoever he happens to have on the air. Now, of course, I've been at this a long time. I was a first minute researcher when my principal came into my class in 1963. I was in the first grade and said, the president had been killed. I wanted to know why. And she said he was shot with a gun. So the only gunshots I had ever seen in my life on TV were like cowboys and Indians. So I thought that maybe somebody shot him like on the street, cowboys and Indian style. And of course, as you get into the subject and as you grow and as you mature, you read books like 4 Days by UPI that sort of started it. And then I sort of got hooked on Rush to Judgment and things like that. So before you know it, I was hooked, and I was hooked hard. I just couldn't believe it because, you know, when you look at the case as a whole, that magic bullet, I know that's what brought Len into the game. That's like beyond, you really got to be somewhere in another planet to try to believe that one, okay? And the bullet itself doesn't match the rifle, so therefore that's sort of like history. Mr. Oswald, or Lee Harvey Oswald, was James Wolcott of the CIA, he was a CIA payroll officer, said in 1978 before the House Assassinations Committee that Oswald was a paid agent of the CIA, a paid operative. And then, of course, you got J. Lee Rankin saying in that Warren Commission memo that they had his CIA payroll number. So all this stuff has been out there for years. And it just blows my mind that nobody wants to pick it up. I think that the crux of the case was broken. Jack White told me this about 25 years ago. He said, listen, he goes, I'm going to die soon. And he didn't die for another 10 years. He goes, I'm going to die soon. He goes, the guy you need to keep your money on is John Armstrong. I said, what do you mean? He goes, he's the guy. He's the only guy that's got money. He can't be influenced by anybody. He's got his own money. He can't be influenced. He goes, and he's anal. He goes, he's more anal than I am. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, listen, he crosses every T and dots every I, not once, but twice. So that sort of got me into the Harvey and Lee book and started reading that and started realizing, you know, this sort of answers a lot of questions. I mean, Harvey getting on the bus and then getting off the bus and getting in the cab, William Whaley's cab, and taking it over there to Beckley Street there and out in Oak Cliff. And then, of course, you've got Lee Oswald coming down the grass and getting into a a Rambler car, a Rambler station wagon that was witnessed by Roger Craig. Now, you can't have it both ways. Either there is a Harvey and a Lee, or there isn't. And I think that Mr. Armstrong has proved beyond a reasonable, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that two of these guys existed. In fact, I can't think of his name right now, but he wrote this big, long book in Dallas about the Tippit killing, and he spent 25 or 30 years on it, and then he had to admit afterwards that John Armstrong was right. He spent 35 years writing a book that, you know, Armstrong sort of like took a bow and arrow and shot an arrow through.
Yeah, are you thinking Joe McBride?
Mr. McBride, exactly. I saw. You know what? I will say this. Of all the authors that I've ever come in contact with, he is one of the most honest guys I've ever met in my life, because when he was wrong, he copped to it. All these other guys, like, you know, you try to get Josiah Thompson to admit the Zapruder film is a cartoon, and he goes berserk. You try to get Robert Groden to admit that the film is a hoax, that it's a fraud, that there's no way in the world, that there is absolutely no way in the world that film is 100% real. And I would stake my life on that. I wouldn't stake my life on too many things, but I would stake my life on that. Okay. But then again, you know, you've got Robert Groden. That's been his pet peeve, his baby, since what, in the 1970s. So he can't come out and say that film's a fake, because it makes him look bad. And you and I know, Linda, that film's got more flaws in it than you can ever imagine. I mean, the shadows on the side of the car, sometimes the car's dull on one side, sometimes it's shiny. I mean, the bodies are moving all over the place. And then you've got people in the middle of the street that are bigger, people in the middle of the street that are 15 feet further than the car from the camera, and they're bigger than the people in the car. Len, I showed you that picture.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, there's a lot of anomalies in the film, I'll say that. You know,
yeah.
just
but anyway. People.
Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, but that's the film thing. But I do want to get into the fact that I've met some wonderful people in this industry, and I call it an industry. I call it the JFK assassination industry. We're a tight group, and you know, I've been together with these guys since 93. We got together for the 30th anniversary in Dallas, Texas, and it sort of took on from there. But I want to mention some of the people that have passed on, and these guys were all stars. These guys were like all pros if there were football teams in the JFK assassination community. Larry Howard and Larry Ray Harris. First, Larry Howard. He and Harris both ran the JFK Assassination Center in Dallas, and that was about a block and a quarter. I think it was on the corner of Main Street in Houston, the JFK Center, and it ran counterculture to the JFK 6th floor museum, which stops at frame 312 or frame 311 of the Zapruder film. In other words, you don't see anything past that as far as JFK getting shot, which way his head goes, which way the brain matter goes, none of that kind of good stuff, okay? But Larry Ray Harris and Larry Howard, you know, they were both part of the Roscoe White thing. And Roscoe White was a cop in Dallas, Texas, who was hired about a month and a half before the assassination. He was also a Marine, and he was stationed with Lee Harvey Oswald in Japan. And if my memory serves me correct, there's a picture of Lee Harvey Oswald with Mr. Roscoe White in the background, or Roscoe White's in the background and Lee Harvey Oswald in the foreground. But the bottom line is these guys had some relationships together. Okay, so this guy becomes a Dallas policeman. He works for the photographic department, and then we find out it's his body in the pictures. I mean, the broken wrist that he had from that accident in the army, that big old lump on his arm, the fact that his chin is shaped the way it is, Oswald's chin is shaped totally different. And what did Oswald say when Captain Fritz showed him those pictures? Hey, that's not me. They took somebody else's head and put my head and put it on somebody else's body. That's not me. I mean, he was adamant from the start. He knew exactly what the game was.
That's a very good observations. I don't want to go too long right now. I'm glad to have you on again if you want to go in depth in all these things. But I just want, you know, get an overview of where you think maybe, are you optimistic about the future? Are you think we're going to solve this? What's your thoughts?
It's been solved. I mean, come on. I mean, it's been solved. I mean, I think Armstrong put this to bed a while back. If you've got Harvey and you've got Lee, and you've got Harvey going over to Russia, and you've got Lee working here in the United States and hanging out with guys that were on Barney Miller's TV show and things like that. So you've got Lee here, you've got Harvey over there. I mean, the mafia cannot put together Harvey and Lee. I mean, they can't do it. I mean, no matter what you want to do, Sam Jam Giancana can't make this guy defect and go to the Russia and all this kind of or allegedly defect and go to Russia. And, you know, you look at the whole thing involving Oswald, the fact that that broad, Marina Oswald, his old lady, and I was there in 1993 when Mark Lane interviewed her at the Dallas conference. A bunch of guys interviewed her, four or five guys. Anyway, I think she was KGB. I mean, she met with the first defector and the third defector of when the defector program started rocking and rolling there in the late 1950s. So the fact that she met one guy in Minsk, I think, and one guy in Moscow, come on, man. I mean, where's a little where's a little 17-year-old scallop or a 17-year-old girl, 18-year-old girl get bus fare or even airfare to fly across the country?
You make some good points. You make some good points.
As far as the research, I beat up Posner in that debate, right? You know, Posner and those guys, when I debated Gerald Posner on, I think it was the Gene Rogers show or something like that, I was kicking the out of him, just beating his ass. And they cut my phone off. They go, "We can't hear Pedro. Something must have happened." And I'm talking, and they're like, yeah, anyway. As far as the future is concerned, I think that young man that you had on the show a few weeks ago that has a 1,000-page book available, that's free. I can't think of his name right now. It slips my mind. But he was excellent. I think he could be part of the future. I think John Armstrong is really, I mean, I think John's got it down. I mean, everything he's put on paper. I've been to Dallas 15, 20 times. I've read the Warren hearings, all 26 volumes, 4.2 million words, something like that. Anyway, what a waste of time that was. But, I think that Armstrong's close. I think that other guys are knocking on the door, but you know, it all has to come around to realizing there's Harvey and Lee, and that's what a lot of guys can't do because it puts a hole in their story, and they don't know how to make up for that hole. But outside of that, I think the research community is hungry and young, and except for that guy that used to be with the NSA that was at that meeting with us, and I won't mention his name, and neither will you. In San Francisco, I think we're all pretty good because except for him and one other guy in the room, I think everybody was on the same. We were all on the same page. I think there were two guys in there that were, how can I put this? They were on the other side of the other team. You hear where I'm coming from on that one?
Sorry, we got a bad connection. I can't hear you, Pedro.
Exactly. Listen, Leno Sanic, Black Op Radio, Thursdays, I don't know what time zone you're in, what time of the world you listen to the show. You can listen to it live, you can listen to it delayed, you can listen to it archives, you can download it. The bottom line is Black Op Radio, as far as JFK assassination is concerned, this is the premier show. And I thank you so much for your time and having me on, Mr. Len.
Okay, thank you. I'm looking forward to having you on again further on. It's just a pleasure to talk to you.
All the best, my brother.
Okay, thank you.
You know, people say he's well-versed in boxing. No, I'm well-versed in political assassinations in the 1960s. I kid you not, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. Not Malcolm X that much, but the Martin Luther King and the Bobby Kennedy assassinations, along with the JFK assassinations, I've studied them intently. I've studied government records that were released. I've studied autopsies, forensic reports, the whole nine yards. Of course, my police background sort of helps a little bit with that. But at the end of the day, what do I have to say? All three men were killed by elements of the U.S. government. Kennedy was killed in a VA coup. Bobby Kennedy was killed by CIA agents down there in L.A. I mean, Mr. Morales, David Morales. Who was David Morales? He was Michael Carbajal's uncle. Michael Carbajal, the 1988 Olympic silver medalist or bronze medalist out of Phoenix, Arizona. That was his uncle. I kid you not. And David Morales told the old man Carbajal's father, I think his name was Ruben, and Ruben told me that he admitted to killing Kennedy and that he was there in L.A. when they killed Bobby Kennedy, too. So we've got pictures of David Morales in the Ambassador Hotel that night, June the 5th, 1968. And, of course, any cops do it with these guys. Got drunk a little bit. You know, when people talk, people get drunk, they talk. That's how it happened. So that's what it came out, David Morales. And then, of course, when he was buried, he died very mysteriously to David Morales back in the 70s and late 1970s. And when they had his funeral, they had 300 cars at his funeral, and they were all limousines that were brought in from other parts of the state. In other words, they didn't have enough limousines for all the secret agents that were going to be there. I kid you not. He was Mr. CIA. Had his own parking space at the CIA. I kid you not. David Morales, and of course that ties into boxing, seeing he was the uncle of Michael Little Hands of Stone Ross Carbajal. You are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide, your inside look in the world of boxing, MMA. Touch a little gear there. Political assassinations in the 1960s. I'm done with that. On the other side of the break, we'll talk Mike Tyson before we finish things up here on Ring Talk Live Worldwide.
Now, more of Ring Talk with Pedro Fernandez.
I'm just ready to get it on and crush this guy's skull.
ESPN, Tuesday, July 21st, 2020, of course, from the bubble, the MGM Grand Las Vegas, Nevada. Of course, said ESPN, ESPN Plus. You got the app that happens as well. Oscar Valdez in the main event, 27 in a zip, taking on Jason Velez, 29-6. What can I say about this fight except that? Valdez is probably about a 3-1 favorite. Some of the other fighters on the card are really not big fighters. I said Dogbo is taking on Chris Avalos. Avalos has lost two of his last three, so I don't know if he's going to win there or not. But Dogbo hasn't fought in like about a year and a half now. And, of course, got drubbed the last time out against the aforementioned Emmanuel Navarrete Martinez. I wonder why he doesn't use that last name Martinez. He uses his mother's name, Navarrete. But the bottom line is, he is a disappointment of the week. The fact that he moved from 122 to 126 pounds without taking care of business at 122 just shows me he doesn't have the intestinal fortitude. He's not the fighter that they thought he was, because he could have made some big money. This would have been an all-Mexico type of shootout, man. Two Mexicans duking it out at 122 pounds. I mean, if you thought Gomez and Sanchez was big when Puerto Rico and Mexico went back and forth, this would have been like a civil war within Mexico, these two guys going back and forth. But it ain't going to happen, and that's too bad. The fights that ain't going to happen are the fights that we miss the most. The UFC, rock and roll, of course, next Saturday. Of course, the last card from Dubai. And if you ever need to go anyplace in the world, don't go to Dubai. Robert Whittaker, the former champion in the main event. He's the former middleweight champion. That's 185 pounds, taking on Darren Till. Mauricio Shogun Rua in the co-main event. He's got to be like 95 years old. He must be on Social. If they have Social Security in Brazil, he's on it. And the other guy's got to have his Social Security and Medicare as well. Antonio Rodrigo Nogueira. Talk about both guys going on like 90 years old. Hey, and Fabricio Werdum, the former champion, taking on a former light heavyweight contender, Alexander Gustafsson. That's on ESPN, ESPN Plus, July 26th from Abu Dhabi, Dubai. Bottom line is, don't ever go to Dubai. You are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide. I thank you so much. There's a million things you can be doing right now. The fact you listen to Ring Talk Live Worldwide, well, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. Scott Cuddy is our executive producer. My name is Pedro Fernandez. Don't forget, Ring Talk Live Worldwide, Saturday and Sunday, 11 a.m. Pacific Time, live on Sports Byline. And, of course, on Anchor.com, the podcast. You're tuned to Ring Talk.